23 July 1985, talking with Dr. Arnold Beckman again for the second session in our oral history interview with him. With me are Arnold Thackeray and Eric Elliott of the Center for History of Chemistry. As I was saying before, we'd like to talk a little bit more about some of the developments during World War II at Beckman, what later became Beckman Instruments. And I wonder if we might start by just asking you to reflect about the state of the art in spectroscopy around 1940. Who were some of the people doing work? Where were they? What kind of contact did you and your colleagues at National Technical Laboratories have with them?
Well, Wash and Lomb was the principal manufacturer of spectrophotometers. They did not make a photoelectric spectrophotometer. There was a visual type of there, or photographic type. And the thought occurred to me after we had developed the amplifier for the pH meter. It has a very stable two-stage couple amplifier that would work well with a vacuum type photocell because it had a high impedance and would match the high impedance of the vacuum type photocell. I say vacuum type because gas filled photocells, which were more sensitive, but gave a very uncertain, irregular response curve. You plot the electrical output versus the light flux input. But with a vacuum type cell, that was a linear function. So that's what really started me in the fact we did have an amplifier already developed that would work with the vacuum type photocell. And the advantages of having a photoelectric spectrophotometer were pretty obvious because, of course, the visual ones were limited to objects that had color. And there are many areas, particularly in the ultraviolet, many organic compounds that absorb light out there do not absorb in the visible. So that was the origin of what became later on the DU spectrophotometer. We started out with a Model D, matter of fact, and our we made three or four experimental spectros that actually plugged into a pH meter to read the electrical output. Then we realized that was not a very efficient way of using instruments, so we incorporated the electronics then later on directly into the spectrophotometer.
In addition to Bausch and Lomb, were there other were some of the other scientific instrument companies or some of the instrument suppliers making spectrometers that people were using at the time?
Yes, I'm trying to think of the what's the German company? Zeiss. Mm-hmm. Zeiss made them.
Mm-hmm.
And I recall an experience after we had the deal on the market. I visited our dealer in Zurich, and he took me on a trip down to Basel to, mm-hmm, I think, to see the guys here, or one of the pharmaceutical manufacturers, and introduced me to the chief research chemist there, and he looked at me strange and said there are two things bothered him. First was that Beckman was a young person. Over there, the Beckman thermometer relates way, way back. And so they expected me to be an old man at that time. Then he pointed over to a table in the corner. There, under a black cloth, was a Zeiss spectrophotometer. Said, we in Germany can't understand how an American come up with an instrument that's superior to the German instrument on there, but there it is, and particularly developed by a young person. So he shook his head in amazement. So Zeiss was, of course, as you know, the principal manufacturer of optical instruments in Germany.
While you were developing the DU, the paper that we discussed a little bit last time was the one that you and Howard Carey had published in the journal The Optical Society of America on the DU. But while you were doing that work, were you looking at other spectrophotometers like the Hardy that GE had produced or any of the other models on the market, or were you in contact with other people who were working in the area?
Actually, we had approached Bausch and Lomb and said, here, we don't have any optics. We have the electronics, and we suggest we work together in putting out a photoelectric spectrophotometer. We'd provide the electronics, and they'd do that. They weren't interested. They said they'd been making spectrotometer for years, and they couldn't see a market for 100 of them. They're just not interested. So we went back, and fortunately, we were small enough that that would be a big market from our view. So we went back and designed our own optical parts of it then.
Around this time, this must have been 1939, 40, around then. When you went to ACS meetings, were chemists becoming more and more interested in spectroscopy as an analytical technique?
Oh, yes. Yes, as the, particularly as organic chemistry developed during that period, where the need for spectrophotochemical methods of analysis is becoming more and more obvious.
Can you think of any, you know, if you and Carrie were talking in 1940 about chemists who might be willing to use the new DU or who might be interested in these kinds of techniques, who were some of the people you would have thought of, you know, who you might have called or gone to see?
Well, as a matter of fact, we were not very much business-oriented in our thinking. We were interested in developing, so we didn't know much about market research or thing like that, so we didn't have any formal surveys of who would might be using this. We were interested, could we make the instrument and put it on the market? See, I had no business training, and Carrie had neither, for that goes, so we were babes in the woods so far as the business world was concerned.
So how did the word get out, in fact? Was it like the acidimeter that someone used one and told their friend?
You see, I mentioned earlier we had a one-man sales force. We didn't have any capital. See, we started with zero capital, so we didn't have the financial resources to build up our own sales force, so we sold through the dealers. As I recall, there were a total finally of 28 dealers. The principal one was right here in Philadelphia, Arthur H. Thomas Company. And Ed Patterson at Arthur H. Thomas was the one who encouraged me to go ahead and build the pH meter, because he was the one who came up with the high figure of 600 pH meters might be sold over 10 years. Well, when we came up with the spectrometer, Arthur H. Thomas, Imer Naumann then in New York, that was before it was acquired by Fisher, Central Scientific in Chicago, V.H. Sard in Chicago, and so on. So we had these dealers, ultimately got 28 on it. Well, they all bought one of these things and sold it pretty soon. So that was the way the word got out. And of course, once they got a few of them out, why, papers began to appear and talks were presented at scientific meetings.
Yeah, speaking of scientific meetings, I noticed in the paper on the photoelectric spectrophotometer that this was due to be presented at one of the MIT conferences on spectroscopy in the summer.
July 41.
And I believe you mentioned in an earlier interview that you and Carrie weren't able to go to that because of restrictions on travel, but that it was read by one of the representatives from Arthur Thomas, I believe.
I think that was Ed Patterson.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So were these, had you gone to earlier conferences on spectroscopy of this MIT series, or was this just...
This probably was the first one, as I recall.
But it seemed like a useful venue for describing the instrument and to a group of people who were very much interested in developing spectroscopy.
Yeah.
Another way that you did get the word out was an ad in Industrial Engineering Chemistry. This was in September of 1941.
Yeah.
And I just, I thought we'd ask you when you thought of advertising in Industrial and Engineering Chemistry and what sort of response that ad and ads like this one from Imer and Ammann's catalog brought in.
Let's see, this had the quartz prism in at that time. Well, this is possibly our first ad on.
I think so, yes.
Well, imagine this is the result. At that time, we'd accumulated enough funds to pay for an ad. So put it in there. I don't recall any specific conferences or thing like that result of discussion say, well, we're going to put an ad in there. It was just sort of a logical thing to do.
Yeah. Now, do you recall who some of the first people were who bought the DU? Some of the companies probably, and well, because Imer and Ammann's catalog listed it at $820, and it's, I'm sure, not many individual chemists had $820 in 1941 or 42.
That price, as I recall, it was $795 when we started, but got up to $820. UCLA claims that they had the first one, and that probably could have been one. I think they had the one that that plugged into a pH meter to read its outfit. That was one of the very earliest models. Then we made another model C, I guess, which had a circular turret for the sample cells. Well, that was not a good design, so then we went over to the sliding cell chain, and that became the model D.
Mm-hmm.
See, so there are A, B, C, and D were successive versions of this thing. And then the D also had a glass prism in. Then when we decided to go over to a quartz prism for ultraviolet, that brought the U in there, the D ultraviolet.
Well, this is just another photograph of it.
This is a later model with a gray case,
mm-hmm.
because the early ones were all in the black.
Mm-hmm. Any color you wanted, as long as it was black.
That's right.
You mentioned that you weren't, at this point, you weren't doing any sophisticated market research, shall we say. But along with Howard Carey and other members of the technical staff of National Technical Laboratories, over the next few years, you did introduce a lot of improvements to the BU. And I wonder if you would talk a little bit about what some of the improvements were in the early years of its introduction and how the ideas came about and who developed them.
Well, we spent a lot of time initially in developing the mechanism for rotating the prism. You see, that had to have a bearing on there, and the friction in that bearing was a critical point because you could deform the arm of the that was moving that thing. So we had to work out, finally got this spherical bearing in there, which was been very, very successful since it. That was one of the problems we had. Another problem we had was a slip mechanism. To find that, there'd be no hysteresis and like that. So we did a lot of development work and testing in our own shop before we got many instruments out in the field. Then one of the major developments, though, was to switch over to a power source for the lamp. See, we originally used batteries on them, and they were a nuisance, so we went over to an AC power supply. That gave us some problems. We had some headaches getting the bugs out of that, but we finally did it. Another problem was the source of the light sources for the ultraviolet. And we finally ended up making our own hydrogen lamp, which later became a deuterium lamp. So now, and also then the photomultiplier, or the photocell, ended up doing it. We could not find on the market a suitable thing that would work in this wavelength region. The reason was they had glass envelopes, which was sufficiently opaque that we couldn't get much light through. So that's when we came up with this design, you remember, with a very thin window inverted coming there, so we'd have the mechanical strength to withstand full vacuum in there, and still very, very thin, so that there's relatively little light absorption. Well, these were major ductal development problems we had.
Were some of those suggestions, were they coming back from people who were using the instrument?
Yes and no. But some of these problems developed in the field. For example, in the early slit mechanism, they'd stick after a while. In the use, so then we say, well, we didn't have a good enough design on that. Also, one very amusing one, in getting the wavelength scale, we thought, well, everybody would want a linear scale. So we had a very clever man. He was an architecture training background. He worked out that if we put on, as I recall, it was a cosine function on or something, we could come up with a linear scale. We put them out and we found out the customers didn't want a linear scale because that crowded all the wavelengths and the ultraviolet down together. So what they wanted was that. So this is a case where we assume something that customers want they didn't want. That's, we had to learn that lesson applied to many things or not, that we could go off the deep end by just thinking in our own laboratory. We had to get out and work with the users to find out what they really wanted, what really the weak points were in the design and things like that.
That's what I was going to ask you about your own, in this period before World War II, about your own traveling and how you interacted with the users. Were you visiting labs, or was it mainly
no.
ACS meetings, or did people come to you, or what?
I'd go to meetings. I was quite active in the American Chemical Society at that time and the Interest Society of America. But then, no, I would go mainly with dealers, you see, because we were selling to dealers. We did not have our own sales force. And this led to increasing problems over the years. For particularly, we were not getting the input from our users back to us. They'd tell our dealers and the dealers wouldn't tell us, so that finally we decided that there's a policy. In the long run, we had to have our own direct sales and service force in there, or else we would not be able to do our job in the long run. This is a very difficult decision because we had some very loyalty, Arthur Thomas. I hated like the Dickens to change that. We had some other dealers that were not so loyal, and this is in the days of the Robinson Patman Act and some of these other non-discrimination acts. And our attorney said we had to deal with our dealers exactly the same way. We couldn't differentiate and select this dealer from that because we'd be open to charge of discrimination. So that was one of the tough decisions to say, to have to break off relations with Arthur H. Thomas and E.H. Curtin in Houston. They're one of our good dealers too. But and that we did that, by the way, 1960, was it, thereabouts. And this had to be kept secret, and we announced it by a full-page ad in the Wall Street Journal because we wanted to announce it simultaneously to all of our dealers. Our lawyer was very, very apprehensive about even difference in time. We let one dealer know 24 hours before the other. So we announced this in a full-page ad. And this was a shock to the investing people because we were listed on the stock market at that time. I said, what's wrong with this company? Here they have all of the dealers, 28 dealers, selling their instruments out there. They're going to pull that away from them. They're going to have all of the 28 dealers now as competitors, and they don't have, Buckman doesn't have its own sales force. So this, a lot of people thought we had lost our reasoning, you see. And it was a tough going there for a while, but finally we built up now, and it was the right decision. Because without direct contact with our users, we wouldn't have been able to develop the product we have over the years.
To go back to the early period again, and around 1940, did you begin to make sort of one trip a year to all the dealers? Did you get a rhythm in this that endured through that 20-year period?
No, this is for our sales manager, Tom Harry. It was his job. He made the trip to the dealers and would take the orders. See, now, we give volume discounts. You see, so we get a buy one instrument dealer might get 10%, if it has three you might get 15%. So Tom Herring's job was to go around and try to get them to order in large enough volume so that we could put these through in production in more economical batches. That was his job. Now, I used to go around also and visit the dealers on an institutional basis, social basis. I did not get involved in the day-to-day writing up the orders. That was his job. But I'd try to go around and tell dealers what was coming on, try to learn from them what the customers wanted in the way of changes or things like that. So.
But with 28 dealers, this implied plenty of traveling.
Yes. It's good little traveling those days.
I wonder if we could ask you for a minute to talk about the structure of National Technical Laboratories around 1940. Howard Carey, through this period, from 37 to about 46, was vice president for development, I guess. I just wondered how many, I mean, that sounds as though you had quite an administrative staff, but I gather that it was a much smaller operation. And I wonder if you'd just talk about, you know, the process from designing the DU to actually putting it into production, shipping it out the door, and what happened in the in your Pasadena office on a day-to-day basis.
Well, we had a small development group. Howard Carey was George, Kenyon George was another one, Doug Marlowe was another one. That was just about it.
Yeah. Were they also from Caltech? Or had they come from elsewhere?
No, Kenyon George was. Kenyon George was, I don't think he had necessarily college education. He was a very skilled machinist. He could make parts. Doug Marlowe had some, but I'm not sure he was a Caltech. I don't think he was a Caltech grad. I have to look back in our records if you want to know that information.
Was he also a physicist or chemist?
George Shull was a Caltech graduate, worked with us. He didn't work much on the spectra. He was more on the glass electrode.
Were those all the technical people at that time? In addition to yourself?
No, we had, I mentioned this man who designed the cosine wave for us, but I've forgotten his name now. He was not a chemist, but he was more of a design, mechanical design engineer. George Shull was a chemist. He left us later on to go to work for Howard Hughes, and he worked on developing the glues that put the spruce grooves together. And let's see, who else do we have back those days? Well, they were the chief ones, certainly. I overlooked one or two hours, I'm sure, but...
So you had a small nucleus of people working on new development. You said you had a one-man sales force, and we've spoken about him a bit. You must have had people working on production, too, and in other areas.
Yes, we started out on East Colorado Street there with Henry Fracker and Bob Barton. These were two students who worked part-time. Bob had his doctor's degree and then went to work for Shell up at Emeryville, Shell Oil Company. Then Fracker was a Caltech graduate who had gone back to Bell Labs and then worked for a couple of years. And then he came back to Caltech, thought he wanted to go on for graduate work, but he just did for a while. He didn't stay on then. But then when we started production, we had a couple of people came in the door. One was Frank Camarda. He was formerly an employee of Western Electric Company in Hawthorne, Illinois, a cable lacer. Well, at that time, we had a job of lacing cables, you know. So he came in to get 2 or 3 weeks' work. He was visiting somebody out there in the summer. He stayed with us for 40 years. He's still living. He's up in Oregon now. But another one was Frank Traphagen. Frank Traphagen was the machinist, a very skilled machinist. So they were the production for Frank and Frank, we used to call them. So Frank Traphagen died over 15 years ago, unfortunately, but Frank Camarda's still living on. So they were the production department. Then we had Johnny Simpson, who was a high school graduate, Bastion. He lived just across the alley, or at least a block away from our place on East Colorado Street in Pasadena. So we brought him in. He did everything. He swept out the floors, and finally I taught him glassblowing. I blew the early glass electrodes myself. I taught him the glassblowing. He developed into a very highly skilled glassblower. Stayed with us for many years until finally he left. He said he wanted to set up his own business, which I encouraged him. and that is now known as glass instruments in Pasadena. And he, do you want these side stories of him? Well, Johnny was a very fine chap, so I said, I can understand your desire to stand on your own feet. Lee thought he had an angel that was going to set him up in business. Mm-hmm. And the idea was they're going to make individual letters of the alphabet filled with neon. And these would have a magnet on so they could be, so grocers could make their own neon signs, you see, by remember. So they started out. I said, well, fine, Johnny, and do that, but have your successor trained. And Sid Parker was his name. He was the son of the chemistry stockroom out of Caltech, you know. So he had got Sid trained. Well, so Sid wants to join me. So I said, well, that means the next in line is Maury Duchesne. Okay, well, I'll train Maury Duchesne. So he stayed on then for a few months longer until he got Maury Duchesne trained in there and went off and started his business. Well, things went all right for a while in his business, and then they began to get into technical trouble. These letters began to develop black spots around the electrodes as the metal would plate off, you know, and finally their angel disappeared and left Johnny and Simpson and Sid Parker holding the bag. Well, we kept them afloat because we gave them enough glass blowing. They knew our business, of course, so we used them as a source of supply until they could build up their other business on them. He still remains a close friend. Sid Parker died, but Johnny Simpson is still living out there. So I mention this as I encourage people to go off on their own, but so long as they do it, open and above, we'll get their successor trained and that. And Maury Duchesne, gosh, he was with us for, he's retired now, but he's with us for 25 years.
Was this a unique example of contracting out, or did it set a pattern that you then followed with other aspects?
Now we're getting into it. Well, trying to think of any other situations quite like that. Now that's about the only one I think where employee set out to set up a business which we could use the products. We
Let me just ask you about a couple of other personnel aspects. One is, were you yourself very directly and principally involved in the selection of people for these different areas?
Yes, I was in the beginning because we didn't have any personnel departments, and I was still teaching at Caltech. I was carrying this on as a part-time activity, nights and weekends like that, until 1939. By that time, the business had got to the size where somebody had to be in there running it full time. That's when I made the decision then to leave Caltech and do that, and that's when we changed the name from National Technical Laboratories to National Postal Meter. You know how we got the name National Technical Laboratory? That grew out of National Postal Meter. I think we covered that earlier.
Yes. Yeah. One other thing about the people, and it's something about the Caltech context or Pasadena. Were there many, many people trying to start up their own business ventures? Would you say
many.
It was an entrepreneurial atmosphere?
That
or
was before
not?
The big surge in that direction. No, there were some, but not many. One person, I'll call another case, a fellow named John Bishop, came in one day in my office in South Pasadena. I had never heard of him. He was a graduate of the Harvard Business School, and he said Beckman Institute was one of the case studies they used. And he was innocent, wondering if we had a job for him. But I was quite impressed by the guy that said, we hired him. And he stayed with us for many years. He's still now, he left later on and set up his own business, in which he's been successful, but we're close friends. That's another case. But I guess we use, he makes electronic amplifiers, and I think from time to time we have purchased things from him.
When did he first come to you, approximately?
Well, let's see, we're in South Pasadena, which means it was after 41 and before 54, because 54 he moved to Fullerton. He had been there several years, so it was in the late 40s or middle late 40s.
So by then, Beckman Instruments was catching the eye of someone in the Harvard business.
Now, here was a case where I brought him in and put him in charge of a department. What we call electronic special.
many, many people trying to start up their own business ventures. Would you say it was an entrepreneurial atmosphere?
That was before the big surge in that direction. No, there were some, but not many. The one person, I call another case, a fellow named John Bishop, came in one day in my office in the South Pasadena. I had never heard of him. He was a graduate of the Harvard Business School, and he said Beckman Institute was one of the case studies they used. And he was innocent, wondering if we had a job for him. But I was quite impressed by the guy, so we hired him. And he stayed with us for many years. He's still now. He left later on and set up his own business, in which he's been successful. But we're close friends, and that's in another case. But I guess we use. He makes electronic amplifiers, and I think from time to time we have purchased things from him.
When did he first come to you? Approximately.
Well, let's see. We're in South Pasadena, which means it was. After 41 and before 54, because 54 he moved to Fullerton. He had been there several years, so it was in the late 40s or middle late 40s.
So by then Beckman Instruments was catching the eye of someone in the Harvard business.
Now here was a case where I brought him in and put him in charge of the department. What we call electronic specialist, I think was his division. Anyway, he was responsible for that, so he did his own hiring and all this and that. He ran. My method of operation was that I wanted to keep small units. I felt that there's an advantage in flexibility in keeping that. So we split up our into different divisions away from the very earliest days, and gave a lot of authority to the managers of those divisions. We had the Hillipot division and the Spectre division, and Jack Bishop got us into computers, analog computers, build that up.
Were you, I'm going now into the war and the post-war period, that as the business was expanding very rapidly, were you reading business textbooks in your spare time, or were you operating intuitively in...
intuitively. No, I've never studied any books on management or any course in management. So I just, as I say, learned the hard way from making mistakes. Now, this is hard to describe, and I hate to say this being particularly public owned, because shareholders might think, what the hell is Beckman doing there if he's not business oriented? I really am not business oriented. I do look at balance sheets and P&L statements and know what you have to have, but the fun, the harder thing is in the technical aspects. I know I have to have this thing be financially successful, but that's for the controller, not that to worry about. I'm concerned more about solving a technical problem, coming up with something that's useful for advancement of science. It's that aspect of it that predominates.
Well, if Beckman Instruments is a very vivid example of the way in which brilliant ideas are paramount in the long haul, I want to ask you a little bit by way of philosophic digression, but there's been a lot of commentary and discussion in recent days about the short-term orientation of American business and the quarterly and semi-annually and annual reporting.
That, I think, is the one consequence of the emphasis on the schools of business administration. And this is one of the serious problems of business. They look at the short term, the quarterly reports, or even monthly reports, the quarterly reports, and it's hard for a manager, a CEO, to resolutely look at the long range and suffer the consequences of adverse short-term results. And this is, I think, being realized more and more now by some businesses, but we went through a period where, in fact, our own company has gone through that, where we look at the monthly reports and get all concerned if one group is up or one group is down, something like that. I think that our business generally and beginning to realize that we have to have the long-range goals in mind.
How does that carry implications for the way people are educated? What is it that we should be doing?
Well, I'll tell you a story that General Doria told me. Remember him? He founded the Harvard Business School. And he said, one problem we have here is that our graduates feel they're a failure in life if they aren't vice president at least 2 or 3 years after they're on the job. He told a story about one of the graduates who was called into the office of the president of his company one day. Said, John, I said, want you to know that I'm going to make you a vice president as of today. John just didn't say anything, on just put one foot in the other. I said, John, is he here? You're vice president of the company now. And so he hasn't got anything. Well, thanks, Dad. Well, so Doria had I was aware of this thing too, that the Harvard Business School guys came out, they thought they were a somewhat superior breed of people. And they were, well, but business training is only part of it. There's understanding of employees, motivation, and things like that, things that at least in many schools of administration are not emphasized, the human factors. So early on, I was lucky to have employee relations manager like Don Strauss, for example, who's grown over the years, and it's paid off. We don't have any unions. We've had 15 union elections over the history of the company, and our employees have turned union down every time when they're, because I feel happy about this, because I think when employees feel they have to have unions to represent them, management has somehow been negligent in coming up with things. So we try to give all the benefits and provide a work atmosphere that employees are happy, and they are. We have these annual service award banquets, you know, and I'm amazed each time come how many long service employees we have, and that's proof of the long range aspects of running a business. It's very expensive, actually, to lose an employee. See, after all, any employee, no matter what his background, learns a lot, has to be taught a lot on the job. And when he leaves, you lose all that experience. So that's one reason why we like to hang on to a long-term employee.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. These questions of entrepreneurship and versus management technique are very interesting, but
they're not complicated. I speak now, having no training in business administration, I can be naive, but I think what it is merely being honest. Be honest with yourself, first of all, and then honest with the employer. I'll give an example. Now, just last week, 2 weeks ago, no, last week, one of our alumni, Albert Ordson, she lives over in Honolulu now. She's with us for 24 years. She came back, and after she'd been out for several years, she came back, came to the plant, and brought Lay's back for me and for Don Stride. She was just in love with the place. And she had tears when she left. She had to go with it. Well, that's the sort of attitude we get. It's a family affair and a loyalty that you can't buy, and you can't generate it by phony techniques. There has to be an empathy there, and I think part of it is that we try to be all the same way. When I go out on the factory floor, I talk to anybody. I'm glad to talk to them. There's no status symbol. Well, he's the number one guy, the next number two guy, number three. None of that. We have to have lines of authority, of course, to do it, everybody can get the boss's attention. Over the years, I used to talk to employees from time to time when we were modest size. So, and here again, I said, naive, no doubt, but I told them the thing to do is to do your best. I said, you're going to make mistakes. If you don't make mistakes, I'm going to come conclude you're not doing much. But making mistakes is part of the job of being nice. And I said, there's one thing, though, one kind of mistake that would not be accepted, and that is a mistake based on any kind of dishonesty or lack of integrity. And I said, the one thing you must not do is ever do anything that makes me ashamed to walk into any of our users' offices or anything like that. You can make mistakes, but they have to be honest, legitimate mistakes. So that's the philosophy, and they've got that too. And our users know that too. They know they can depend on us, regardless of whether it's a hard and fast written agreement. If something's wrong, something like that, we correct it. And we go in over the years. For example, we give a year's warranty on our instruments. If an instrument fails within a year, we repair it at our expense. Well, that means that puts a pressure on our employees to come up with high quality, because it's very costly to go out in the field and repair an instrument. So our employees feel a necessity of maintaining the highest quality in the construction of the instrument and in the design too.
When you were making the decision to leave Caltech and to go full time with this venture, did you have what would now be called any role models, any people that you said, well, X has done this and I admire him and the way he has done it, and these things that you're talking about, like the integrity of in the organization?
No, I don't recall any role model that anyone has put in. Just built up gradually, and finally got to the point where in 39 they say somebody had to run the show full time, and it was a case of whether I tried to do that or whether I went out and hired a professional to do it. And that was a very difficult decision to make, because at that time the Caltech, particularly the chemistry department, was pure science oriented. The scientists looked down a little bit on anybody working in applied science or something like that, and particularly anything that savored of commercialism was frowned on. That's why I was careful. None of the pH meter development was tied into Caltech. It had nothing to do with my research. It is a little different from the present burst in entrepreneurship we see in the whole genetic engineering field. So the pH meter, as I mentioned earlier, was just a chance development that I did a favor for Glenn Joseph. My own research was quantum theory of photochemical reaction. It had nothing to do with pH. So I kept it out entirely on there. But nevertheless, I felt even my name, if I went out and called a Beckman instrument when I'm still on the faculty at Caltech, there might be some in a place. So it's only when I decided to separate entirely from Caltech that I changed them from National Technical Laboratories to Beckman Instruments. And saying that was a tough decision, because I enjoyed my association with Caltech, and also I had a little feeling, which is an extension of this attitude of the pure scientist, that anybody engaged in commercialism was somehow a sort of a second level citizen on here. And it was a really tough decision made over the years, though. I thought also, am I, as I say, prostituting my scientific training by leaving academia and going into industry? Well, I've overcome that over the years by many friends say, well, you've done more for science by making thousands of instruments available for others than you would have done with your own two hands in the laboratory. Well, I hope they're right. I don't argue with them too strongly on that.
Well, that shows your good judgment once again.
But no, it's having no business training, a lot of things I didn't do in an ordinary way, but I looked on business, put it the same way I'd look on research. You encounter problems, they're tough problems, you wonder how to solve them, and you learn pretty soon the thing to do is to break the problem down into components if you can. Finally get small enough pieces that you know how to attack that. Well, it's true whether it's a financial problem or whether it's a technical problem, whatnot. Break the problem. Well, first of all, I go back and I learned that the most important thing probably is to recognize what the problem is. Because it's so easy to think you know the problem, and you start to solve that and you find out that's not really the problem after all, it's something else. So I stress that. Be sure you know what the problem is before you start attacking. Then when you get it, then break it down into pieces and solve it into pieces, and you get on with the work. Mm-hmm. And
that coupled with absolute integrity, I'm speaking not now of a financial thing, but intellectual integrity. Don't kid yourself. Don't allow yourself to be the victim of wishful thinking. Those two are the fundamentals of my concept of how to run a business.
Just to stay on allied themes for one moment more, and then we'll go back into some of the technical areas. I'm sure that out there in chemistry and engineering classes in college students today, there are numerous chemists, chemical engineers, thinking that, well, that one day they'd like to be pioneering their own business. So what would you say to them in terms of training, out of the light of your own experience?
Well, first of all, I think they should get trained in the areas of science or engineering that they're interested in. They must have the competence, first of all. And then I say they must have some level of common sense. It's so easy to get this come back again, to engage in wishful thinking. Think you've got something and picture yourself. That's the dangerous thing. You have to be realistic approach. And that involves such things, for example, a person has an idea, thinks he can commercialize. Is there a market there? What's the competitive? Just some of the common sense things you do anyway. A person has to go through that. That's them. Oh, there are also practical things. I've seen many small companies fail because they utilize their initial capital, which is usually small, in the wrong ways. They'll fix up a good office, they'll spend it on typewriters and desks and things like that. They'll use up all their capital in non-productive things instead of using it for working capital for doing. It's amazing how often that phenomenon appears. They want to put on a prestigious front on there. Well, we didn't, and I think that's a mistake. We started a tin shed, you know, and gradually build up. So make use of your available working capital, whatever it is, in the extent you can, and producing something that has a profit attached to it.
Well, that gets us back to the next question I wanted to ask about the technical matters. In developing the DU, I gather you must have financed that out of earnings from the pH meter. Is that how it was?
That's right.
And when a year or so later, when you began working on the IR-1 and the helipod, which were more or less simultaneous, did the money for that come from the contracts from the government? You must have had to do more development work and put on more production.
No, we didn't have development contracts. These were selling the products. Now, this was the day this wasn't in the good old days where the government said, here's a lot of money to go ahead and do something. No.
There was production contracts.
Even on the helipod, for example, which is strictly government. The government didn't give us $1 for development. Oh. They said, we'll buy the things from you when you get them. Mm-hmm. So we had to absorb all that development cost out of our accumulated earnings from pH meters.
Did the cost of the contract cover your cost of gearing up to meet this vastly expanded production?
Not in that era. Later on, as we became a little more sophisticated, we got the government to put up money, or even private companies. For example, later on, we got IBM to put in $700,000 to build a plant for us so we could make more little resistive devices for them. But that's after we got a little more sophisticated. But we didn't ever had these grants from NIH or things like that in those early days. This is purely our own money was being risked. Matter of fact, we weren't alone in them. The whole trend of industrial development changed during the war. Mm-hmm. See, when the war came on, we hear there was an urgency on part of the government, and they then became much more generous and were willing to put money into these things. But that came later.
You started to tell us earlier about getting involved in the infrared developments with the synthetic rubber project. Could you tell us again about how that came about, how you were invited to the Detroit meeting in 1945?
The Office of Rubber Reserve, it's Oliver I'll think of the name.
Yes, we'll track it down.
One person in charge there, and he was the one who called this conference and said we had Bratton was there and Barnes was there and others. And at this decision, the officer of reserve made the decision to, first of all, use infrared techniques, and second was they thought that Bob Bratton's design was the one to go, and that was a single beam thing, and very, very crude, had no relation to an infrared. It was parts assembled on a surface plate, you know, this, to get a flat, heavy surface on there.
Yeah, here's a description of that.
Yeah. That was 41. Yeah, I don't remember. I've forgotten this article. I probably read it on here, but well, how they adopted this, I don't know. Bob Bratton was a I don't say an aggressive person, but he was pretty well convinced that what he was doing was the right thing, and I imagine he conveyed this impression. You know, there it is. It's all laid out on a flat base on here, and had the advantage of being on a. Of course, we had masses, enough weight there that it wasn't so susceptible to motion by displacement by vibration. And also, these are all freely located. You see, they could move them around, just fasten down to the base, so that was the advantage on them. I recall a detail also that he had a straight slit, well, one of the things we put in, we curved the slit to. So we could get a little higher resolution out of the thing. And, we made 100 of these things, I recall, was the order that we got from Officer River Reserve.
Yes. And the machine that Bowling Barnes and Van Zandt Williams had built at American Cyanamid around the same time, where they were they had the problem of analyzing butane and isobutane mixtures, used a... it had the thermocouple output was tied to a deflecting galvanometer, so that the output was then photographically recorded from the galvanometer beam. And it occurred to me that one way of making the output, and this is something, in fact, that Barnes and Williams mentioned in an article, one way of making the output more accurate, or recording it more accurately, was to get some kind of photoelectric mechanism in there, which was the same problem that you faced with Glenn Joseph and the pH meter, wasn't it?
Well, this we used a galvanometer on this. Mm-hmm. Legion Northrop HS galvanometer with an optical beam, one meter scale out there, and that was mm-hmm. the recording thing on this too. Yeah, it was the same problem though. How are you going to measure electrical output down in the 10th to minus 8th, 9th mm-hmm. ampere region on there?
Did you eventually design it so that you could use an electronic amplifier in the circuit? Was that...
No, we had the amplifiers in our pH meter, parallel at this time, so that then later on, when we realized this is a good way of measuring the output of a photocell, that was applied then to this.
To the IR as well as
IR,
the DU.
Yeah.
Was that during the war, or would that have been after the war?
Well, that was 41, 42, during the war.
Yeah, I see. The visible and UV spectroscopy community, but IR was a newer technique, wasn't it? At least as far as using it for analytical purposes.
Yeah, that was used to extend the range. See, the quartz prism, the DU, would wear in the near ultraviolet and near infrared, but this extended the infrared range out much farther.
Yeah, had you and the other people working with you had contact with Barnes and Van Zandt Williams and Dudley Williams and Norman Wright and some of the other people working on IR spectroscopy at that time?
Yes, there were meetings at technical mm-hmm. conventions and things like that. And in this, of course, there's a rather ironical situation. See, Bowling Barnes instrument was a double beam instrument. Ours is a single beam. That's clear. Well, Bowling Barnes, we're pretty cocky about and proud of ourselves having got the contract for this thing. Well, that was a very costly contract from the standpoint that our users were all subject to secrecy classifications. They were not allowed to publish themselves. Bowling Barnes users were not. So he could go out and sell to the general public. And so he did sell. And these people could publish. So the literature then, for a period of two or three, several years in there, until the end of the war, in fact, was entirely related to the use of the Bowling Barnes instrument. Meantime, why, people didn't know. We'd actually made more spectrophotometers than Bowling Barnes had, but there was nothing in the literature. And I said, we had one heck of a sales problem when the war was over, because all the literature for that, and you know, people wanted to use new instruments, refer back to the literature, what did so-and-so use? Well, it was a Barnes instrument. So we had an uphill battle for years. In fact, one time we had to make a decision, are we going to be in the infrared business or not? So I made the decision that yes, and we're going to be the leader in the infrared field. So we spent a tremendous amount of money on development and subsequent models of infrared spectrums that have come along. But this was again a business matter that we didn't anticipate when we got this.
Barnes went to Perkin-Elmer right after the war, and I guess it was Perkin-Elmer instruments that you're talking about. Did they also sell through the dealers, or did they have their own sales force at that time?
They had their own sales force, but they sold through some dealers also. Mm-hmm.
So it was, in a sense, they were competing for your prime market, which was the dealers, who then...
Another factor began to be recognized on here, that dealers, by and large, were not able to handle sophisticated instruments. They could handle a balance or something like that, but when you come to a spectrophotometer, that involved more expertise than their salesman really had. So that the more costly, more sophisticated instruments really were not suitable for dealer handling. That was being recognized for Perkin-Elmer. There were some sales in there, but it was sort of a vague gray area.
When do you think that problem really began to be recognized? Was it already emerging before World War II, or was it a problem that really grew under the conditions of war?
I don't think it had really anything to do much with the war. It was the nature of the instruments. Yeah. Say they could handle a pH meter because they had a little portable thing, and if you had a service call, it worked, you could put the instrument up, take it back to the shop. You couldn't do that with a spectrophotometer. That's when you had to have then a trained service force. That was, I can't pinpoint very well in years, but it was when instruments of this degree of sophistication began to be used that the need for trained service people began to be recognized. And a few dealers, such as Arthur H. Thomas, did provide these trained people, but many dealers didn't. And when anything went wrong, they blamed the manufacturer, even though they were given a very substantial discount to provide that service. They weren't doing it. They say, well, the manufacturers had fault on here. So that was one of the reasons, say, that began to be a very costly situation, and we realized we had to change.
Yeah. This was all in the background of your 1960 decision.
That's right.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, this is just a photo we had of the innards of the IR-1.
IR-1, yeah.
And that gives us... one can see visually how it is a much more complicated instrument than some of the earlier ones. So.
Yeah. And this had just what a great big sheet iron cover, which,
Jim, we do want to keep going for another hour, and in the interest of not getting too tired, I wonder if it might make sense to take a five-minute break. Just pause for a minute or two, put the air conditioner back on for a minute or two, and then do a second session. All right.
excuse me, both of which were developed during the war for and sold to the government for synthetic rubber and use in the radar, in the development of radar. What other projects did Beckman Instruments work on during World War II related to wartime work for the government?
Those are the main ones. I'm trying to think of any other special project.
You'd mentioned some work for the Manhattan Project.
Oh, yes, we did make some mass spectrometers.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, that's right, I forgot about it. We made Geiger counters and like mm-hmm. that, too, I forgot about that. And also we made these little pocket electroscope thing for measuring dosage, you know, and carry them. Yeah, I forgot all about that. That was made in another company, that was made in Arlo Beckman Inc., so remember that was this other setup we made to make oxygen analyzers, you know, that Pauling had developed. And our board of directors didn't want to take that on because it was under secrecy wraps, and they said they didn't want to buy a pig in the poke. And that, well, I got permission then to do this as a personal venture to help out my friends at Caltech. A lot of interesting stories connection with making that. Did I talk about that?
No, please do. I'd like to hear more about
it. We had worked out at Holmes Sturdivant, who was an assistant to Pauling, came over one day and wondered whether I'd provide him with 100 wooden boxes for an oxygen analyzer. And I found out that the Navy had asked Caltech, and all I was involved, to come up with an instrument for measuring the partial pressure of oxygen. They hoped to use it on board submarines.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a demonstration instrument to show that they could use the phenomenon that Faraday had used, based on the fact that oxygen is paramagnetic. It's almost one of the only common mm-hmm. molecules that is paramagnetic. All the others are diamagnetic. Slightly. So if you measure the paramagnetic susceptibility, why, you could measure oxygen for all practical purposes. And a very simple instrument, you just had a magnetic field with a field gradient in there, and then they put a little ball in there, a little glass ball, and they used two of them because the, like a dumbbell, because the mechanical forces were much greater than the magnetic force you measure. So you balance that, and that was suspended on a quartz fiber, and that would rotate slightly in and out of the magnetic field until the magnetic force was exactly balanced by the torsional force in the quartz fiber. And then you had a little mirror on that, a beam of light, and you have a spot of light going on the scale. Very simple thing. It worked. So they were going to make 100 of them. And we provided with the boxes. Then it came back later on, wondering whether we'd make the instrument. They found out that making 100 instruments to predetermined specification was a little bit different than making one demonstration model. And they had a group of people, none of whom had ever worked before, girls primarily, and then doing this thing. So this is what I brought to our board of directors. Said, no, we don't want to do it. So I set up a little place over on State Street there and passed in nearby, and I took over the group from Caltech. And well, what a good, fine people, but none of them ever worked before. And they came in and started to make these things. Well, one of the main problems they had to solve was what kind of background music were they going to have. They knew that industry had background music. Well, you're going to have popular music, you're going to have classical music, or something like that. Well, this thing, but worry about this. In the meantime, they couldn't make these things. Now, this oxygen analyzer involved making these little bulbs about an eighth of an inch in diameter, very thin wall of glass, and joining them together so they're perfectly balanced. Well, making those bulbs was quite a problem. I didn't realize this because I taught glass blowing, among other things, at Caltech, and I didn't give a second thought to this. These were made by blowing a bulb on the end of a very small capillary, which was the connecting link between the two. Well, the surface tension of molten glass at that small radius of curvature is such that it takes about all the force you can generate with your lung to overcome. Mm-hmm. And as soon as the bulb goes any, the radius, it just blows out like that. Well,
I know.
Caltech had one man that could do it, Herb Sargent. He was a PhD candidate in organic curvature chemistry. He worked the technique that he could learn just how to coordinate his muscles and clamp down, bite down on the blowing tube, something like that. He could get maybe 1 out of 100 or 1 out of 200 that wouldn't blow out. That was a source of supply. And he was leaving Caltech in about 3 or 4 months, got his degree to go back. Well, it's not a very reliable source of supply. And this caught me completely unaware. So I went down, realized what was wrong. It had a mismatch in the capacity of this small bulb and volume of your lungs. So what you had to have was they make a blowing machine, which had a small bulb, a small source of air, compressed air, which would pressure would drop down automatically. So I went down shop one weekend and made probably the world's smallest glass blowing machine. There's nothing more than a sliding valve, you see, which you had to a little depression, a little volume in there. You could transfer that over from a tank of oxygen or air over to the thing. But of course, since the volume was small, as soon as the bulb began to blow, well, the pressure went down. So we went over to about 100% yield, 99% yield of one. But that was one of the things I had to do. That was used in production then for years and years and years. Well, that's one of the things we had to learn. And also then you balance these things. We had the balancing was very difficult. The mechanical force were 100,000 times something like that, what the magnetic force. We had to balance this very, very carefully. We do this initially by putting little dabs of glass. We finally got down to the point that wasn't it. So we got the final balancing by vaporizing on silver chloride. Just a little bit of that, because you couldn't touch the thing, you see, to vaporize. And we got so we could balance these things beautifully on it. You could twist around and all of them. The other thing was making the quartz fiber strong enough, because that had to be. And if we learned the techniques on that, you make a fork out of a fused quartz, fused silicate, and then we just mechanically compress that a little bit, seal the fiber in, and then we had to learn just enough to put the right tension on that. And we had to draw these fibers. See, the torsion, I think, terms I recall on the fourth power or something like that of the diameter. So we had to draw these down precisely. The way they were, you know, the way they were making the quartz fiber that time, they take a small quartz rod, maybe a half millimeter in diameter or something like that, heat it up in an oxidizer flame, pull it out properly coated, and it'd pull apart. And somewhere in there then was a quartz fiber of the right diameter. You couldn't see it. So the way they would do it, they take a label and wet it and pinch it, make a V out of it, and where they thought it was, they'll push that out there and squeeze the label together, and then if it fell to the floor, they didn't have it. If they had the fiber near, well, it would swing. That was the way they actually got the fiber. Well, we had to learn how to draw these contingent, put up a bicycle wheel and spin around things like that. Well, these were some of the problems we had working on there. And we finally made them. We didn't supply many to the Navy because the United States Navy, because they were still arguing over specifications when the war ended. We sold quite a few to the British Navy, but the sales of it were just demanded. And then in 1953 or 4, an article appeared in the Saturday Evening Post. I recall by two doctors from Johns Hopkins, I recall. They'd been concerned over the blindness, high degree of blindness in premature babies. Something like 1/3 of all the babies would be permanently blinded. And doing a piece of chemical detective work, they found out that the incidence of blindness was highest in the so-called best hospitals, those that had the best equipment. found what they were using these infant incubator, I call them, running up high oxygen content in there to help them breathe. But when they got over 40%, then retroventral fibroplasia came in, permanently damaging things. So that what you had to do is keep the oxygen down below 40%. Well, that article appeared in Saturday Evening Post, not in a technical journal. Well, our sales led up because pregnant mothers would ask the hospital if you got one of these oxygen analyzers. So that was the story of the oxygen analyzer.
Was that after the war?
It was after the war. 53 or 54, right in there. This article appeared in the Saturday Evening Post.
How long did Arnold Beckman Inc.?
Well, that carried on then for several years. And when they began to sell oxygen analyzers in some quantity, then we began to have confusion between our customers. What's Arnold O. Beckman Inc. and what's Beckman Instruments Inc.? So we finally decided we ought to fold a thing. So I told the board of directors, sure, I'm going to stay out of this thing. If you want to buy it, you come up with what you think is a fair price, and I'll take it. So they did, and I forget what it was. $1 million, some round number they put on there at that time, and that was a good fair price. So that's, we merged the two at that time.
Now, was that the first entry of Beckman Instruments into the health field? No,
the pH meter then.
That had been used.
Inspectors were all used in health. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, I recall. Matter of fact, we rushed up airmail a spectrometer to a hospital in Oakland where Mrs. Kaiser was very ill and like that, try to save her life from that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, that just shows my own short-sightedness. I always think of pH meters and spectrophotometers in chemical laboratories and not thinking of them in clinical applications. So it's they had been used from early on. Yeah.
Yes, both of them are widely used in hospitals and medical research.
Let me ask you a couple of things about the period before the end of the war, and then we may go into some of the post-war things. The first is that when you took on as president of Arnold O. Beckman, you've mentioned your board.
Board?
Your board of, you had a board of directors.
That's a Beckman Instruments.
I meant when you became president of Beckman Instruments.
Yeah.
That who were some of the early members of that board, and how did you organize that?
Yeah, they were members of the National Postal Meter Company, and they consisted of Lowell Stanley, who was the accountant and the treasurer of National Postal Meter, and continued on almost until his death. He died just a few months ago. There's Jurgens, A.T. Jurgens. Then Fred Ehrman, who was a partner of Lehman Brothers at that time. What happened on that was that there was a group of investment bankers, FIRE or something like that, of which Lehman Brothers was the lead person. They bought Jurgens Oil Company. And in the course of buying that, they found that here was an asset, called Beckman Instruments over there. Well, they came over to see what it was. We were in South Pasadena struggling and all. Well, the other members of this investment group were not interested in this thing, but Fred Ehrman was, so he stayed on. The rest of them bowed out of this thing. And so he came on our board, and that was my first introduction to finance, certainly to investment, because up to this time we'd grown entirely out of earnings. And he saw our growth curve on here, which is still about 50% a year out of earnings. He said, could you go faster if you had more money? I said, yes, because we have a lot of research we'd like to do. We can't afford to take on this to say when we're making the decision, did we dare to go into NMR or anything like that? We're limited solely by the available funds. We could borrow money, but I was reluctant to borrow more than have more than 25% of our total equity tied up in loans. That was an arbitrary number. I said, well, why don't you go public? And so we went public then in 52, I think so. Mm-hmm. I think that's right. Mm-hmm. And that was a result of Fred Ehrman. Owned Ellen Ray Westman, who was the lawyer for R.A. Westman for W.A.E.S.T.M.A.N. He was a lawyer for the Jergens Oil Company.
Mm-hmm.
That was, and Buzz, no, I.H. Lyons, who was president of the National Postmaster Company. That was the board.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it was very heavily influenced by the
origin. They owned it, you see. Mm-hmm. And we never did have a board, I guess, for Arnold Beckman Inc.
The other question I wanted to ask in let's say 1944, when the war was in full swing, but the promise of the end of it was there. What was the breakdown of your products in terms of dollar volume, and what were you thinking about the post-war
world? Well,
I'll
have to get the number. My memory is not good. I can get that for you. I should point out there that we had split off Hewlett-Packard. Munson Hewlett-Packard had made 40% of our profit in the first thing. Well, as time went on, we got concerned because they were tremendous. We couldn't make them fast enough. Oh, no, that was a limitation. We were concerned that the government might force us to stop making pH meters and things like that. We did not carry the AAA priority, put all of our production into Hewlett-Packard. So we split off Hewlett-Packard as a separate corporation. And that was in this period on here. And then later on, we folded it back into the company again after we moved out to Fullerton after 54. That was so that I have to give you both Hewlett-Packard and Beckman Instruments to me, but I remind me to get that information.
Hewlett-Packard must have, clearly you're making thousands of those. You were making thousands of Hewlett-Packards, but only about 100 IR instruments. Do you recall about how many pH meters were being made then? Was in order of magnitude?
Well, I can give you the actual numbers on that.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I'll get to those. Sure, how they go. Yeah.
And the Hewlett-Packard was
going. I think we sold 87 meters the first year, 100 and I'm guessing now, but anyway, in connection with our 50-year history, we did bring out those year-by-year figures the first few years.
Yeah. Well, as you looked at the likely shape of the post-war world, what did it, what implications was it carrying about?
You're making an assumption, you see, that I did look ahead. I was enjoying myself going to make these things. I have to confess, at that time, I did not sit down and come up with any long-range projections. Mm-hmm. Later on, after Fred Ehrman came on the board, then we did that, because he brought in some more of the conventional investment reasoning that had come on here.
Was that a direct consequence of going public, do you think?
I think so. Yeah, I think if it hadn't gone public, it was just a happy little family affair, drifting along and trying to stay in the black and things like that. But he brought in a larger scale look where you had outside shareholders. You have a different type of responsibility then.
Mm-hmm. Going into the post-war world, when did you begin to get actively re-involved with Caltech? By 1964, you were chairman of the board. But
yes, I went back on the board in 53, was it? I think so. Yeah, I think it was, because I maintained close personal relations. We lived right there, you see, and went to parties together and went to seminars. So that I never lost contact. I lost official relationship with it, but of course then through the following auction, I was the biggest contributor to their patent royalty fund there for one, not a lot of dollar, but still it was the largest one, but the only one there for a while. So I maintained close relations. And I recall I was back on the board. See, DeBridge came back in 46, and I think it was on the board in 53. Norman Chandler, LA, owner of the LA Times, and I went on the same time. And I don't want to become chairman in 65 or something to do.
Yes. The early period of Caltech with Millikan and Hale and so on has been studied from a historical point of view. But the era immediately after World War II is not yet subject to historical scrutiny. Who were the great architects of this? Yeah. Who do you see as the key?
You see, Caltech was going through a changing thing. I mentioned earlier that Caltech was a pure science institution, and its people did not get heavily involved. There were a few who could do consulting work, particularly like Dr. Lacey, for example, who was head of the... We didn't have chemical engineering. We called it applied chemistry in those days. Well, Dr. Noyes encouraged him to have some kind of limited contact, primarily with the Petroleum Institute. He was studying the thermodynamic. He and Bruce Sage were studying the thermodynamic properties, you know, of hydrocarbons under high pressure and temperature. So that was a one. And in the electrical engineering department, Dr. Sorensen and others were concerned with the high voltage transmission of electricity. Mm-hmm. And the water, the Metropolitan Water District coming along, and Dr. Franklin Thomas was involved. But these were pretty largely special, large-scale projects of interest to Southern California, and the instance that it had an obligation to help out the local community if it could. And well, that was just about the situation. And then World War II came along, and the physicists particularly gotten into chemistry, but particularly physicists got involved, and they set up a facility up in the Royal Hotel. You had a lot of physicists, you got Smyth, you had Dumond, trying to think who were the leading physicists there. Of course, Watson, Ernest Watson, who was Millikan's man Friday, and he was involved in this with him. And the chemist Pauling was involved in this thing. Well, this where they went out and really put together a what we'd call later a think tank sort of a operation up there. And this is the first time that Caltech really wholeheartedly got behind a practical applied type of activity. Get away from the. So this is when the tide turned. Now, since then, and they found also they got paid handsomely for this consulting work, which may or may not have had something to do with the acceptance of that role.
Was there, in the years immediately after World War II, was there a serious thinking about going back to the way of doing business in the 30s, or did people all see this as an irreversible change?
You have to keep in mind, I'm not on the faculty at Caltech at that time, you see, so I'm a little bit of an outsider. But no, I think that the change was permanent. You see, they were, for two or three reasons. First is, I think they saw that science by itself, for sake of knowledge, was really not a complete story. Until you use science some way for the benefit of mankind, while you haven't completed. So I think that was brought home to them. And also, I think they learned that applied science was not necessarily dull and low level of intellect involved or something like that, which some of them assumed before. And otherwise, they found that highly interesting, I think, to be involved in the problems of industry as well as his government. So I think it's a whole change in they open up their eyes to a new world for many of them on there, with the world of applied science.
Just staying with Caltech for a minute, that in your period as chairman of the board there, what would you characterize as the major opportunities and problems that you faced, and the major thrust of that period as you now look at it?
For one thing, that was the first time that Caltech had to put on a fundraising drive. Up to this time, money had come in primarily by personal solicitation of Milliken. He was a great fundraiser, but there'd been no formal organized drive, so we put on a drive. As I recall, it was either $16 million or $19 million, or put it on a scale now. And I remember that. Tell you another. I don't want to bore you with these human interest stories, but it's all these things have a. Well, I, in 30. Yeah, that's just a little early. This is in. I lived 58, I guess it was. And I've forgotten the year. And I was having a boat built up at Sausalito, one of the first large fiberglass boats, 40 foot tall. And I was sailing it down and over the Thanksgiving holiday of 58, I think it was. And this is right our fundraising drive. And I was chairman of the fundraising thing. And we were having a meeting scheduled in Caltech to ask them there to kick this thing off. So I recall it was on a Monday evening. And we're sailing down with the boat, and we got becalmed. And I realized it was not going to get down here by 1 o'clock. So finally we pulled over at Goleta. There's an old, partly abandoned pier sticking out there. And I hopped off and went over to the highway to get to hitchhike a ride so I could get in. And finally, this is my first experience in hitchhiking, and it's not that easy. All these cars go whizzing by, whizzing by, whizzing by. Finally, a fella stopped in an old T-shirt, and he's a plumber. He'd been up at Camp Roberts hoping to get a job, and he did get one, so he was coming by. So he stopped and picked me up and told me I'd get back to Santa Barbara where I could telephone and stuff like that. So he put me in. Turned out that he and I had a little in common. We were both former Marines. He also was an AA, which I was not, but anyway, we got along well at that. And he took me home. But when I got to Santa Barbara, I called Ed Valentine, who owned the Robertson store there, his family did. He was the vice chairman. I called Ed and said, I'm not going to get back here in time for this thing. Will you go over and hold the meetings? All right. So he did that. And the next day or day after that, the Los Angeles Times had a column about Arnold Beckman hitchhiking down from San Francisco. He wasn't able to make it in time to kick off this thing, you know. But of course, they played it up. But right along the next picture, and there was Zsa Gabor. They had something about her. So I never lived down that hitchhiking experience. But I mean, that, like, the main thing now, of course, is the modesty of that campaign compared to what we had now. We don't have $100 or $200 or $300 million, right? We don't call it a campaign. That was one of the first things we had in there. And Caltech was gradually expanding the way through, and there was always a problem on campus as to whether engineering was being slighted with respect to science. The engineers thought that's perpetual problem on Earth, but that was
what could you do with that problem except sympathetically listen?
Well, we sit down and talk with him, and the guy, I think that was when Bob Cannon, I think, we brought in as director, head of the engineering school, and things like that. No, you just have to, this is a problem that the provost has to handle, see how you're going to allocate the funds between the two. That'll always be a problem. And to a lesser extent within the scientific division too. The biologists think they don't get as much as they should too much, the chemists get too much. The chemists have always fared pretty well at Caltech, and I think that's go back to the days of Arthur Noyes. And the fact they've had a good chemistry department there that they've Now I'm trying to think of developments during that period. That'd be 64, I guess, to 74 was a 10-year period when I was chairman. Do you recall anything that...
No, I'm actually, since it's not as a matter of historical record, I'm...
$300 million rights, if you don't call it a campaign.
Yeah.
That was one of the first things we had in there. And Caltech was gradually expanding the way through, and there's always a problem on campus as to whether engineering was being slighted with respect to science. The engineers thought, well, that's a perpetual problem on Earth, but that was...
What could you do with that problem except sympathetically listen?
Well, we sit down and talk with him, and the guy, I think that was when Bob Cannon, I think, was brought in as director, head of the engineering school, and said, that, no, you just have to, this is a problem that the provost has to handle, see how you're going to allocate the funds between the two. That'll always be a problem. And to a lesser extent, within the scientific division, too, the biologists think they don't get as much as they should. Too much, the chemists get too much. The chemists have always fared pretty well at Caltech, and I think that's go back to the days of Arthur Noyes. And the fact they've had a good chemistry department there that they've. Now I'm trying to think of developments during that period. That'd be 64, I guess, to 74 was a 10-year period when I was chairman. Do you recall anything that...
No, I'm actually, since it's not as a matter of historical record, I'm...
One thing that occurs to me is that was, if you look nationally at the way in which research monies were allocated and where money for R&D was coming, the period of the late 60s was the heyday of federal and especially defense-supportive research. And then after about 68 or 69, there was a relative decline in the amount of federal funds for research and development.
Down the Johnson years when they really went down. Yeah.
And I'm just wondering how that affected Caltech, as it must have, that the change in the complexion of support for research and development.
Yes, it... See, Caltech has already been able to raise a fair amount of money. People like Milliken when he was there and success, because it had the reputation. And also Southern California, around the Los Angeles, Fresno area, was building up with affluent people wanted to do it. So that Caltech did not have the fundraising problems that many other schools had. We could find individual donors that would come in and underwrite a project and this sort. So that, as I recall, we were not overly concerned with fundraising the way we are now, for example, on here. And also, Milliken and Noyes and others had a good little weight still in Washington
in the National Science Foundation, and that's where they had clout back there. So I don't recall now we really stayed awake nights worrying about how we're going to keep the doors of Caltech open.
So Caltech never really came to depend solely on federal funding the way many other research universities do.
Well, it got up to around the 50% point. Now, that was one thing I was concerned about when the special committee, when they got up over 42 or 3%, we had the special committee, are we getting too dependent on it? And it's around 54 or 5% now, something like that. It gets a little difficult to do the accounting because Caltech, you see, runs JPL, and that's bigger than Caltech. They got 5,000 people up there, you see, and the budget of, what is the budget now?
Large.
Something like that, you know, I've got to figure. Well, so that began to have a strong effect on Caltech, and there was concern expressed by some of the faculty as to whether or not we were doing too much, and the influence of JPL would deflect Caltech from its basic science approach. That question comes up every now and then, and particularly during the late 60s, early 70s, when you had all the student activism down there, there was a lot of concern at Caltech whether or not any defense research would come on in. They have a flat rule that no classified work will be carried on at Caltech. For a long time, we had it at JPL. Now, in the last few years, an increasing amount, probably going up about 25% now, something like that, of JPL's activity is defense-oriented, classified. But the pressure and concern on the campus has died down.
You know, that rule is still in force at the Caltech campus. I'm asking the question out of ignorance now.
Yeah.
Presumably in World War II there was no such rule.
Well, we don't have a rule of the problem. That's what I say. Under the pressure of the patriotism drive, they set up this think tank up and took over the Ryerseco and hotels and just devoted themselves to it. No, this is the case of get on and win the war. And it's only after that they begin to concern about it.
When did that concern develop? Do you know? Was it already there in 64? Was the rule already there when you were chairman of the trustees that there should be no classified research at Caltech?
I don't think so. I think that came later, of course. This was a rule by the faculty. See, the board did not do it. This is a faculty function. I keep that clear. So our board stayed out of the academic decisions. I think it came later on. See, nothing was there until 46, and then DeBridge came in. And this came in under DeBridge's regime, all right.
Well, there are a couple of technical areas, at least, that we should probably get back to. One is the air pollution, the air pollution area, and the other is the Shockley and the transistor
typical
area.
On air pollution, I got involved in that because I was active in the Los Angeles Chamber of Commerce. I was president in 56 and head of the so-called science committee. Well, in the effort to get butadiene, the local gas company had a project. It was cracking oil and then quenching it into the, and it had a plant down on Vignes Street, I guess, down there at least, about not too far from the City Hall. The City Hall had just built a new building. But one day when they put this plant on stream, all the air got filled with phenols, aldehydes, all these things from the crackness thing, you know, from this open, and they had to shut down this building. And hue and cry came up about that, and Paul Jeffries, retired president of Union Pacific, Sarikov, was finally put in charge of a special committee. This is a big hullabaloo in Connecticut, they're done. But what to do about it? Well, there are many proofs down in the city of Bremen, which is a park, you know, of Los Angeles, surrounded by the city of Bremen. Bethlehem Steel is there, and Hank Richfield Oil, they had a refinery, and there are polluting, seriously polluting industries. But they were in a separate city, so the county, either the county or city of Los Angeles, could invade Bremen and make them enforce it. So a bill was passed, and the state legislature, Assembly Bill 1 by Mr. Stewart, Assembly Stewart from Pasadena, which created air pollution control districts with county boundaries on them, see, which gave them authority to invade any part of even municipalities in there to enforce air pollution regulations. Well, that was the beginning of the first thing. So now they got the powers. They had to set up a district then, and they did, and they brought in chemical engineer from the University of Illinois. And he was under pressure. He was the first director. And he was under tremendous newspaper pressure. The newspaper, in fact, if you notice, I got some old clippings of those days. And even the ministers got up and they talked about these murderous sulfurous fumes from Hades were coming on here now and all this stuff. And we all assumed it was sulfur dioxide was causing all this trouble. And put all this together. The reason for that was they passed an air pollution law which specified that the effluent from a stack cannot have more than 0.2% SO2 by volume. The list was written in there not on the basis that we had SO2, but lawyers know right now based on precedent. The only real air pollution case in the law books was up at British Columbia, don't know what's the name of the town. It'll come to me. Anyway, there's a smelter up there, and this is an international suit that involved Canada and America. And this, the sulfur dioxide from this unit had blight and killer vegetation for quite a way around it. And the litigation finally ended on that they were the limiting sulfur dioxide was 0.2%. The volume. Well, that was written into the California Code. Then everybody assumed, well, sulfur dioxide must be the pollutant because that's the only pollutant measured in the code. And so that's when the press took it up, this murderous sulfurous fume or something like that. Well, Dr. Lou McCabe, and he came out, and poor guy was under pressure. And so he even suggested that we bring out some of the surplus ammonia plants that we have and react with the sulfur dioxide and make ammonium sulfate, which would give a source of revenue and make the thing support it well. So I was chairman of the scientific committee of the Chamber of Health. Part of the problem at Illinois, we go up an inspection trip up to the Gale around there, you know, you can smell SO2 as you well, and your nose is about low, far below 0.2% of volume, so I know this is not sulfur dioxide, so that Lou's a hell, you're going to make a boo-boo here going ahead with it, you'd better analyze the air and see what is in the air before you start to bring in the facility to remove it. So Hagensmith was over at Caltech, and he was running the microchemical laboratory that I got as a service for the biology department primarily, and so I persuaded Hoggy to make a couple of analyses. So we got a group together, Gordon Allergy, one of it, Farah and Hoggy and McCabe and Vivian, I think you have Dr. Vivian from USC is in them. So we passed some of about 500 cubic meters of air through some liquid nitrogen traps and got a little drop or two of smelly brown stuff. I gave it to Hoggy. He analyzed and said, this is peroxy organic material. Peroxy butanes or something like that. Well, At this time, the Western Oil and Gas Association had retained Abe Zirum to study the air pollution problem. And Abe says, there's nothing to that. He doesn't know what he's talking about. Well, it was arranged for Abe to come over, and this is how they want to tone some of this down, but this is the truth of the way we're talking. So we arranged for Abe Zirum to come over to Caltech to give a lecture on this down in the chemistry lecture room. Then I got Hargis, but took him there and had him sit down next to me. And Abe said he studied these peroxy compounds, and they were not eye irritating with the given that. They didn't smell, anything like that. It's unfortunate that a chemist of Harlan Smith's caliber would be misled with this thing. Well, Harlan's been around, he's a Dutchman, you know, he's a damn good chemist too. He just doesn't tell me I don't know what to do. So the strength of I got him to agree to take a year's leave of absence. Probably this time he didn't know anything about that. He was working on root growth hormones and things like that, and a lot of other biological work involving very good microchemistry. But he finally got a dandruff and said, okay, so we got him released from Caltech for a year, set up a laboratory in Los Angeles, and that's when he worked on it and worked out the photochemical step. Found that the sunlight was captured by nitrogen dioxide, you see, and then finally transferred over to oxygen to form ozone. That was how that got started. Well, in the meantime, the press was full of stuff on sulfur dioxide, and the oil industry was saying there's nothing to it. The problem was the backyard incinerator. At that time, they did have backyard incinerator. So I lived at that time up in about 1,400 feet up at the mouth of Eaton Canyon. Hardy used to come up to my house early in the morning when the incinerator was out. It's a rather interesting phenomenon. The smoke would come up for these incinerators, then it would spread out narrowly. And all of a sudden, the stratification came on there. And all we had a meeting. And on the Huntington Hotel, Steve Rice had just had, the dining room, crystal dining room, just decorated. And we had a meeting with Charlie Heinemann, I think it was the director of research for Chrysler, I think it was, and representative from Ford there too. They're trying to say that automobiles are not this thing, it's just the incinerator. Sure, if they had one of the gallon cans and they stuffed some newspaper in it and set fire to it right there on the dining room table, the smoke came up and they said, we just got too bad, a lot of money to have this. So they were decorated. Well, this is part of the thing they had. They had a fire department there. Well, anyway, Governor Young and put in a special emphasis on the chairman. Lee Brantley was on it, and Howard Schmidt, and I think Gordon Ellis, and another one whose name I forgot. So we met a lot of times, and we finally came back with a report, which was the air pollution Bible for a long time. And on the strength of that, Hal Kennedy, who was the Los Angeles County Council, wrote what are now the basis of the existing laws. So we set up the alert system, the three stages, and things like that, and I spent hours with him like that. So that was how the air pollution regulation got started in California. And I recall another incident. A group of us, Fred Harvey, was head of, we flew back in his plane to Detroit one weekend to try to inform the other 95 water lines ahead of them. They couldn't meet with them in a group because they were the antitrust thing, so we had to meet with them individually. And I recall took a meeting on Sunday night with Henry Ford the second. He had a little bit of a drinking problem at that time. Well, he sat there and said, well, it's just another delegation so trying to tell us how to run the automobile industry. That was the attitude he had. And we tried to tell him, no, we're trying to tell you what you're facing in the way of regulation and requirements you're going to have to make. They wouldn't do it. So the point we tried to make is that there are two approaches we see in this. And in our report, we've recommended going back to the get away from the possible internal combustion engine, go back to a steam boiler type, or like the, was it Thompson engine, was it a Sterling engine, I guess. Mm-hmm. And he said, we thought that this deserved study, You have two choices, either come up with a non-purging engine or clean up the dirty exhaust. They chose the latter. And I suspect they did it because they could see a big repeat business on repeating afterburners, which is unfortunate, but anyway, that was part of the thing. We tried to get the message to the other manufacturers, and they turned us down. I think if we'd spent the amount of money we spent on afterburner research on developing non-polluting engine, we'd have a non-polluting engine. Now, whether it's a Stirling engine, or whether it be a hydrogen-fueled engine, or Lord knows what, but we have to come to that. But that was another episode in there. Well, then later on, Nixon appointed me to a member for 4 years of the National Air Pollution Board. That's when Ruckelshaus was head of it. Yeah. And even that time, sulfur dioxide was still burnt in the mind of people as being the main pollutant.
Well, the automobile testing has just reached the Philadelphia area. It was just made mandatory this last year.
We have now, well, we do have now. I just had Miss Beckman car. It costs $42 to have a $6 just for the certificate from out to little college. So. Well, these things go around, might work for somebody else, but of course, we make smog analysis. Instrumentation, the other probes you just stick up to. So I shouldn't complain, I guess.
Before we end, I wonder if you would tell us the story about Shockley and the transistor.
Yeah. Shockley called me up one Sunday night, as I recall, when he was still at Bell Labs, and wanted to know whether I would go on the board of a company he was thinking of starting. He was thinking of leaving Bell Labs and starting a company to make transistors. And I asked him a little bit more, what about it, who else is going to be on the board, and so on. It turned out that he was going to have a board composed of almost everybody who was in the instrument business. All of them would be competitors with him. I said, you can't do that. You have such a thing as conflict of interest, Shockley. If you want to do this, come out and talk to us. He came out and talked to them and found out that he wanted to go to business and make some money. Anybody could make money. He had nothing but contempt for businessmen. Hell, there's anybody from us. So we said, okay, we'll back. We set up the Shockley Laboratories then up in Mountain View. That's where he selected to want to go. And I was guilty of not being severe enough on Shockley. Shockley claimed, I guess it's true, that he was a former, not a student, but I helped him out when he was getting his PhD at Caltech, that I made some thermocouples for him or something like that anyway, but he was very friendly to me, so we set him up to. Well, Shockley was unbelievably naive. He knew nothing at all about business. Worst of all, he was convinced that business was nothing to it. Anybody did. So, and he insisted on running the show his way. So that's where I was guilty of letting him have too much leeway on it. But that was my method of operation, as I told you earlier. I set up an operator, put someone in charge, and let him run. Well, he attracted the best people in the country there. Gordon Moore, Jim Attach, you know, and others on there. And they started them pretty soon. One day they came to me and said, here, we can't work with Shockley. Either got to get rid of him or get rid of us. Well, it was one of my misdirected feeling of loyalty. I felt I owed to Shockley to give him enough a chance to prove it. So that I said, well, I'm not going to fire Shockley up at this stage on the basis of what you had. So they left and formed Fairchild. And then later on, as you know, the history of the whole semiconductor industry. Have you ever seen this genealogical chart that Dr. Linville made? And all these, all composed of people who employed the work. Some other company get an idea or dissatisfied, so they go and start an over. That's the whole thing. It's a dog eat dog industry in there. But anyway, it started with Shockley. Well, he it's unbelievable something you have. For example, you're going to have his pay scale made not on the basis of profit made, but on the number of publications that a person made. That was his idea.
A novel idea?
Yes, it was a novel idea. Another one was that he got the idea that he couldn't trust everybody, so he was going to make everybody take a lie detector test so that he would know whom he could trust. Well, this is what, so I could say the same other practice. It's just unbelievable now to look back and suppose that I had the tolerance to, or the, maybe that's too kind a word, to put up with this on there. But anyway, it was a critical thing. I didn't know enough about Shockey at the time when this other group came and said, either Shockey or Seth. I don't know now. I said goodbye to Shockey, and I probably ought to have been very much involved in the semiconductor business. But I didn't.
So we
carried on for a while, and finally it got to the point that we could see that he was just incapable of running an operation, so we sold it to Clevite company and got out of it.
When was that?
Well, about a half, it been going about a year or something. I'd have to look back and see the date.
Yeah. But in fact, Beckham Instruments has got re-involved in that world indirectly with the way in which computers have become linked.
We're getting back into the computer and applied. If you will, you see, this is off the Hewlett-Packard. So the Hewlett-Packard developed, and then we had all kinds of little ones and big ones, and like that Multitron, and with taps on, so you get non-linear and all sorts of things. But then people began to use them, particularly the military, at high temperatures. The higher they were designed to go, they would char the organic insulating material. So then we developed the CERMETs. These are glasses, a sort of a ceramic metallic thing. And it's a whole new technique. You don't have the wire on thing. You apply these with a silk screen process, you see. And that opened up, and these could be run at high temperature. So that was a whole new product line on them, the CERMET materials. Well, and that led to making resistor elements. We put 10 or 20 resistor elements. See, and making very, very low cost, because you just use a silk screen process, you see, and put all these on a substrate of alumina or whatever we're going to use, and that, then you fire them. And that's it, just the way you make integrated circuitry. Now you see, like, put a whole bunch on the wave. It's the same sort of a thing, except that not to that degree of sophistication. But anyway, this cut the cost down. Instead of $4 or $5 for Hewlett-Packard, it was a matter of a few cents. So that opened up a market, you see. So we became one of the biggest producers of resistor elements and capacitors. These things that are for automatic machine insertion. You see, this is totally automated. Even in our own plant, we'd almost automated. We'd have to silk screen them by hand, but then you fire them in a furnace, and then these things would go into a be cut up, and then they'd go into automatic testing equipment. And here we had a laser that would go through and trim out and form of this mat. It would trim the individual system. Customer blueprints. You have been automatic. That's right. Then you see this thing go in, and the laser come on and trim it down. You come up now with a unit with, say, 10 or 20 individual resistors, each going out to its terminal, trimmed down to a little tenth of 1%, something like that. Then these are all put into tubes for automatic injection in the automatic assembly. And so we made it with millions on this. Far cry from chemical analysis, but still with a logical development, step by step, going down there. That we sold to, after we merged with Smith Kline, they sold that off along for Hewlett Packard to Emerson Electric, which was a very sad thing for me personally, because I'd been in the original Hewlett Packard there like that, and in charge this. But anyway, that's the life is. The company decided to concentrate on healthcare, which is a philosophy I don't necessarily subscribe to. I think that when you're in research and development, you never know where an idea is going to come from, what field. Take Hewlett-Packard. We start out to make hydrogen ion measuring thing. If anybody told me that we were going to be in the electronic component business, we didn't even know. So we had not even measured the linearity or curve, because we didn't use it with a scale. All we had was a fine study. It was a radiation laboratory that measured it and said, hey, these are precision dots. We didn't even know.
Yes.
And that developed into over $100 million business.
Yes. If we may go, as we get to the end, a little bit towards some crystal gazing rather than retrospecting, what do you see as some of the directions that the instrumentation?
Well, there's several things that are clear. First, there's the miniaturization. So you're getting smaller and smaller and smaller with all the advantages on there. The more rapid when you do that. And the other is that the use of microprocessors. All instruments, most all them, are going to have built into, they're going to feed directly into computers. And everything will go out of it. We have now, for example, we have a Fourier transform spectrophotometer that has built into it a lasers. It had built an interferometer. We control the position of the mirror to a fraction of a millionth of an inch in there, probably 300 times a second, I think we do it. Here's a very sophisticated compact. We're in a single manual control on the whole thing. So that's what's coming in. We're going to take the user out of the loop in there and be in a robot type of a thing. And I see that extending to here. Even on our pH meter, we're getting smaller. I'm surprised the market still keeps up for pH meters. We're coming up with new models all the time. We've got a new one which I haven't yet seen, which I've described, because it's a little thing that incorporates the electrode and everything all together, and a thing about it, an inch and a half down, but it's like us. I'm waiting to see one of them. But anyway, the market continues as a result, possibly, of new applications and new models that prevent the application of the older models or not. Sort of before.
Is there, coupled with this increase in the complexity of the instrument, has there been a shift in the way that the ideas come? Or
clear. First is the miniaturization. So you're getting smaller and smaller and smaller with all the advantages on there. They're more rugged when you do that. The other is that the use of microprocessors. All instruments, virtual all instruments, are going to have built into, they're going to feed directly into computers, and everything will be automated. We have now, for example, we have a Fourier transform spectrophotometer that has built into it a lasers. It had built an interferometer. We control the position of the mirror to a fraction of a millionth of an inch in there, probably 300 times a second, I think we do this. Here's a very sophisticated compact. We're in a single manual control on the whole thing. So that's what's coming in. We're going to take the user out of the loop in there and be in a robot type of a thing. And I see that extending to here. Even on our pH meter, we're getting smaller. I'm surprised the market still keeps up for pH meters. We're coming up with new models all the time. We've got a new one which I haven't yet seen, and just have described. It's a little thing that incorporates the electrode and everything all together, and a thing about an inch and a half diameter, about this large. I'm waiting to see one of them. But anyway, the market continues as a result, possibly, of new applications and new models that lend their application of the older models or not, sort of before.
Is there, coupled with this increase in the complexity of the instrument, has there been a shift in the way that the ideas come, or is it still very much getting a very strong user-driven input that people are...
Well, I think all those factors are there. We have customers. Now, for example, go back to the old pots. You had customers who want to run these things alongside of a hot exhaust pipe, for example, and you couldn't use organic. Now, that's the case where it's feedback from the customer. That led us over to Cermes. Once you got this silkscreen technique, that lowered the cost much in there. That opens up getting into resistors and all sorts of
not only this, we also make a lot of AC-DC converters and things like that could be made by this silk screen thing. So once you start a new technique, why the other thing open up? Then sometimes a guy will sit back in the corner and come up with an idea out of the blue, and that, I don't think I could assign quantitatively what fraction of the new products are going to come this way or that way. They're all at work. And the pressures of competition, of course, stimulate you to come up with something new all the time.
You mentioned earlier that the man from Zeiss couldn't believe that. Looking now internationally, where is the competition coming from in instrumentation?
In chemical analysis instrumentation, the chief competition is Japan. They're coming in, and more so than Germany or England or Switzerland. I'm surprised a little bit that the Germans haven't been doing more in here. No, but Japan is really on the make in many fields. You know, another strategy, maybe I'm responsible to some extent for Japan being in this semiconductor business. I'd tell you that story.
Yeah.
I'll fill you a lot of irrelevant material, but this is all true story. Back in 1956, I was president of the Los Angeles Chamber of Commerce, and Tokyo was celebrating its 500th anniversary that year by having a World Mayor's Conference. And Mayor Norris Paulson of Los Angeles was ill, and he couldn't go. So he asked me to go as the president of Los Angeles Chamber of Commerce, his deputy. So I went over there. Well, you know, protocol is you have to take a gift from over there, so what to take? Well, believe it or not, the Chamber of Commerce decided that the thing to take was a transistor radio. At that time, they were brand new. There was only one on the market made by Zenith. That's all they had. And they got one of these, about this modest size radio, and they put it in a beautiful leather case, embossed the seal of City of Los Angeles, so on, something like that. That took it over. Well, when I got over there, I won't bore the details, but I was late. I missed the grand opening ceremony because the plane was late and so on. But anyway, I got over there. They have a protocol officer come around and find out what are the gifts that the guests are going to give, and then they determine the pecking order. Well, I was hoping I was going to be pretty well down the list because I didn't know what the procedure was, and particularly since I was late for the missed the opening things, I missed the instructions that they may have given to the other people. So then when I saw some of the gifts that other we've given, for example, the mayor of Tehran had a beautiful bowl out of woven strands of silver and gold, and I thought, my gosh, this radio thing, believe it or not, this was selected as the number one thing, and I had to go for it. They had a procession first of all, and also given this radio. Well, it was because of novelty, that they had never seen a radio, never heard of it before. So I often wonder whether that was what kicked off the semiconductor business, because only a short time after this, Toshiba, with whom we had a joint venture operation, became the world's largest manufacturer at that time of germanium transistors, but that set us off. Well, all these little pieces fit in. You see that nothing is very important in itself, but still they happen, and you can't say, I won't know, for example, to what extent, if any, that stimulated their technical people to say, hey, we better get into the radio. And we'll come back to computers now. Well, the same way, these little dips and sips we make, you see, go into computer thing. Here again, we had no idea of ever getting into the cheap electronic component business, but we're there.
Yes. Well, those aspects of unpredictability are very very interesting.
I don't know. Well, I can predict a little bit.
in the near term on here. For example, we're going to have, particularly in the field we're going on the healthcare thing, and diagnostic techniques are going to rely more and more on the chemical identification of hormones and neurotransmitters and things like that that either induce diseases or are the byproducts of diseases, so that, as you know, we can now pick up cancers of different type by the metabolic products that we can pick up. This is just an infancy that's going to grow. So the whole nature of medical diagnosis is going to change, in my opinion. It means the nature of instrumentation, too. We're going to have instruments that will do these things and not only measure these things, but they'll measure several of them. They'll have a computer in there that'll tell you what the significance is, and they'll come up with a diagnosis. They'll come up with a therapy. Hmm. All this is going to be done by unskilled people and technicians and like that. So it's going to revolutionize the field of medicine. I think that's for sure. We're so deeply involved in that now that I can feel very certain about that.
Yeah.
Now what goes beyond that, I don't know. I look back, I gave a talk a year or so ago at Illinois on industry-university relations, and I try to point out that I think that our universities are antiquated. We still stick to a four-year course. Why? No reason other than that's the way we've always done it. And it's just ridiculous to think you can cram an education into a person of 4 years that's going to last very long. Point out my own case here. I was an educated guy back in the 20s. Bachelor's, master's, doctors in chemistry, something like that, you know. I'd never even heard of penicillin or streptomycin. I'd never even heard of a transistor, integrated circuit, any of these things that are commonplace now. But my point is that what they should do in school is teach people how to learn and then make it easy for everybody at all stages of life to go back into the educational system and continue the learning process. But then when I look back, say, now that was 50 years ago. But, yeah. We have more people doing research now than ever before, so that discoveries are bound to increase in number. No reason to believe that research suddenly becomes sterile. So what the new developments are, just as we didn't know what a transistor was, I don't know what X is going to be 10, 20 years out the road, but we know there's going to be something just as, maybe we'll be harnessing the internal forces of the nucleus, who knows. So we can project only a year or two or three into the future to see what we can do.
Well, very good. Jeff, have we?
Yes, well, we've
covered the...
I think we've covered most of the territory we wanted to today. It's been a long and eventful way back from Cullum, Illinois, where we started when you were here in April. And I'd like to thank you again for taking the time to talk to us.
You've got a lot of irrelevant material in here.
There's a lot of nuggets in there as well, though. And I think the story is a fascinating one. That, as Jeff says, it's a long way from Cullum, and I think part of the aspect of all of this is making it more known to people what it is possible to achieve. That this is
also an
inspiration.
There's more to science than just the science itself. Science is carried on by human beings. You have all the frailties of human beings and all the other daily problems and like that are woven into these things. Incidentally, I thank very much for that information about that AA noise and Mulliken. Hughes steals 14 weeks in county. I hadn't known that before.
I thought you might be interested.
Yeah, that was great. Yeah.
Well, let's just take a minute's break. Perhaps we'll put the air conditioner on again and.